Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, here we are, third hour. Thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. Very much appreciate it. And as you know, if you've been listening for the last 2 hours, we're focusing on emails today. And we'll probably do this more often, quite frankly, because we get so much email from you. I appreciate all your emails. I read all of them. If you want to send me an email, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on links, and then you'll see a link for contact. That's the form where you can send me an email, and it comes right to me. And if possible, I will read it on the air. And let's see if maybe some of these in my stack here might be from you. Let's see. This one comes in from Judy. She says, I think I heard on Patrick's show recently that there should be no physical intimacy for people dating, such as kissing or embracing, other than hugging to say goodbye. This topic does not apply to me, since my husband and I have been married for over 40 years. My husband and I were discussing this with a group of other devout Catholic friends who also listen frequently, and they suggested I reach out to you to clarify this topic. Thank you so much for your consideration. This is from Judy, and Judy's writing from Wisconsin. Well, Judy, thank you. And you know, it's funny because the subject line, Cyrus, for her email was hugs and kisses. And I had to take a, I had to look at it twice because because she wasn't saying that to me. It was a description of the comments that I made. No, I get it, Judy. You're happily married. I totally understand. As I recall, it wasn't that long ago, I got a phone call on the show asking about what would the church say is permissible for a couple who's dating, you know, and maybe an engaged couple. So reconstructing from memory, what I remember saying, Judy, is that signs of affection like that, especially for an engaged couple, would be, I think the church says, would be fine as long as they don't cause you to teeter on the brink of falling into sexual sin. And some signs of affection, some displays of affection, can actually do that. And so a kiss or a hug, certainly a goodbye hug or goodbye kiss, I don't think there's anything that the, I don't think the church would say you shouldn't do that. And here again, I'm trying to reflect what I understand the church's general disposition to be on this issue. There's no doctrine where the church says these specific activities are prohibited. Rather, it's more of the spirit of, since we're all called to perfection, we're all called to holiness, and a big part of holiness is to be pure of heart, as Jesus said, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God, and also to be chaste in body. So purity is what is the virtue that governs what you think of, what you think about, your imagination, your attitudes. And chastity is the virtue that governs your bodily actions. So you could be pure and chaste. You could be impure and chaste in this, in a small C sense, of where maybe your mind is filled with impure thoughts. Even if you don't act out any of those thoughts in a bodily way, somebody could be impure mentally and yet still maintain a kind of small C chastity, not in a virtuous sense. But I don't think it's possible to be to be pure of mind and unchaste of body. And that's, I think, the territory that we're talking about here, is that if the two people who are heading toward marriage really love each other and are really serious about being followers of Jesus, really serious about living up to his ideal about being pure of heart, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. Well, that would include your thoughts and your attitudes. And Jesus said, if a man looks at a woman with lust in his heart, he's already committed adultery with her. So even our thoughts can be, if we allow them to be, they can run away with us and be problematic. All the more so, I think is what I was saying, how that can be accelerated if we give into liberties with each other that would quickly lead to falling into serious sin, or we would put ourselves in the near occasion of sin, we being the married couple. I'm sorry, the dating couple. So some specifics that I remember saying was, and by the way, for the sake of parents who have children who are too young and for whom this would not be age appropriate, fair warning. Go ahead, Cyrus, and say it.
Ready, steady, go.
Ready, steady, go. Right. So we'll just, you know, talk about this issue for a minute or two. If you need to turn the radio down for the sake of your kiddos, be sure to do that. Fair warning. So things like open mouth kissing, all of these things are appropriate for, and married couples may participate in any of these displays of affection. And because they're married, they are permitted and even encouraged to show these intimate forms of love for each other in a physical sense, because it's appropriate to their state in life. And it also is congruent, it's consistent with, it's coherent with their married state and the fact that they are, they're doing the things that lead to procreation. And these displays of affection, these ways of showing romantic love, are proper in that context because they tend to lead toward that activity. And that's a good thing for married couples. It's not a good thing for unmarried couples. And the reason why I think the people who really are saintly and wise, and the ones who tell us that you shouldn't be open mouth kissing with someone you're dating, you shouldn't be open mouth kissing with someone even that you're engaged to, not because you don't love the person or not because you're not planning to get married, but because you're not married yet. So what I have told the young men who have dated and courted my daughters before they got married, not all of them went on to marry my daughters, but what I would tell them when they would come home to meet me is I would say, keep your hands to yourself. You know, your hands belong in your pockets or, you know, behind your back or wherever, but they don't belong on my daughter. And I don't want them on my daughter. And the reason is because one thing leads to another. We're all human beings. We all have a threshold or a limit to which we can withstand our emotions and our physical appetites. And that is a very strong physical appetite. So I guess what I'm trying to say in a roundabout sort of way, Judy, is that it would be better, in my view, and I think I'm accurately transmitting what I understand the church's approach to this topic to be, not to have no display of affection. I don't think the church would say that. I don't think the church would say that you can't kiss and you can't hug, but be careful of what kind of hug, what kind of kiss it is, because human physiology and emotions being what they are, those can be like a runaway fire. Little fire starts in the kitchen, you better put that out very quickly because it can spread very quickly and burn the house down. And that's what you don't want. Thanks for the question. Let's go now to Victor, who writes in to say, hello, Patrick. There is an interesting correlation in someone just flippantly doing a Nazi salute. You're doing it just for fun and don't believe in any Nazi philosophy, but the mere fact of doing it says something to other people and has way more meaning behind it. Ergo, doing yoga poses that honor and pray to their gods says a lot, even if you have no intention to follow their religion. Besides, I've read a lot on the Indian Ministry of Yoga, he's referring to the website, and what they are promoting, and you were very kind to them and their aims. There is a lot behind that ministry, and we will not even get into the pervasive sexual innuendos that go along with this. Keep up the good work, Victor. Okay, thanks, Victor. I think you're referring to at least on two or three occasions in the last few years, I have referred to yoga in the context of the Indian government and how, as we have in the United States, different cabinet level secretary positions, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Defense, etc. They have the same kind of cabinet setup. They're ministers as opposed to secretaries, but they also have a cabinet level ministry for yoga. And not only the current president or prime minister of India, Narendra Modi, not only is he a very staunch Hindu and also a very avid promoter of Hinduism and also yoga, but in watching some of his speeches and listening to some of the things that he's written and said, it has become more apparent to me that the people in India who are Hindu, who promote yoga, they kind of look in a way, they kind of look with mixed emotions at those of us in the West, insofar as they see people in the West who are doing yoga as a purely stretching exercise, breathing, stretching, concentration, meditation kind of exercise. And they like that because they promote it and they think everybody should do it. But when it comes to mixed emotions, they also, and Modi would be an example of this, have expressed a kind of exasperation that many people in the West don't realize that this is actually a religious practice. It's not merely stretching. It's not merely breathing and breath control or meditation to calm your nerves and things like that. And they're very upfront about saying this is part of Hinduism. And you can do it in ignorance and not really realize what you're doing, or you can do it with much more information. And their goal, of course, if they had their druthers, would be that everybody would become Hindu, because that's what they believe. So what you're talking about here, Victor, and I'm glad you took the time to test what you heard me say on the radio program. And it's not that people are expected to take my word for it. But if you go to the federal government of India and their website, you will find the Ministry of Yoga. And there are a lot of articles there about how they encourage it. They want people to do it, but they also want people to realize the Hindu spiritual connection with it. So to your point about doing the Nazi salute, now I brought that up in an earlier program, and maybe that's what you're reacting to. And that is that even if you were to, let's say kids playing around and they saw World War II movies or they saw something else and they didn't really know who Hitler was or they didn't really know what Nazism was. A lot of people nowadays don't know. They call people Nazis, but they don't even really realize what National Socialists were in Germany in the 1930s and beyond. So imagine a kid doing a Nazi salute because he thinks it's funny. He doesn't know what that means, but other people do. And so part of the problem here is that if somebody did that, it carries a meaning whether or not the person who does it realizes it. It carries a meaning that sends a signal, sends a message, whether or not the person who did it, the kid on the playground, whether or not he realizes that. And the same would be true, let's say, I mean, this is a family show, but I'm going to put it this way just because, let's say extending your middle finger towards somebody. I mean, that has a meaning. And if you saw your three-year-old doing that in total innocence and he didn't know, I mean, he's just pointing. That's, you know, that's what kids do. They point with different fingers and he points with that finger. And you'd say, don't do that. Well, why not? Well, this, you know, just that means something bad. Well, what does it mean? Well, I'll tell you later when you get grown up. Responsible parents are going to tell their kids there are just some things like that that you don't even necessarily have to know what that means right now. Eventually you'll know. But right now the thing is, don't do it. There is a dimension of this that's involved in yoga. And I realize it's an unpopular thing to say, mainly because yoga is so popular nowadays and it's seen to be a very good health remedy, and people who have high blood pressure and other problems, obesity, they can help to remedy those things by doing yoga. And I don't disagree. I don't dispute the fact that there may be some health benefits to it, but it's more than just that. So my advice would be aware of the connotations and the meanings. He mentioned sexual innuendo. Well, you know, I'm not an expert on yoga, but having done some reading on the topic and looking at it from that standpoint, that is true. There are some of the postures that are intended to symbolize certain things like that. And I'll leave it at that. That's all I really want to say on the topic, because whenever it comes up, sometimes people get a little bit uptight and defensive, and that's not what I'm here to do. I'm not here to make anyone defensive, but rather to point out that there may be more to this than you realize, and it's always a good idea to think about it before you do it, to make sure that you're not inadvertently doing something that you'd look back on later with regret. This one comes in from Janus, who says, Mr. Madrid, you can call me Patrick. The Catholic Church recognizes the second book of Maccabees in the Old Testament as canonical. In that book, chapter 1, verses 18 through 36, there is a reference in a so-called miracle of Nephthar. Nehemiah put a quote-unquote thick water on a sacrificial altar, and when the sun gave its light over it, a fire was suddenly lighted. We know that this thick water was naphtha, in other words, a form of refined petroleum or oil that is common in the Middle East. We also know that naphtha is an extremely flammable liquid, thus it would be easy to blaze up. So my question is, where exactly is the miracle in this story? It lies just upon a blazing of flammable liquid? If so, why does Scripture refer to it as a miracle? And if it was Nehemiah, 420 years BC, who really gave the name of naphtha to that liquid, why does the same word appear in the earlier text of Daniel, and more specifically in the Song of the Three Youths? Thanks for your time. Sincerely, Jonas. Okay, well, this to me seems to be an example of maybe where science eventually caught up with what people understood the world to be. There was a time when many people thought the world was flat, and then science caught up with that and showed that science, that the world is not flat, that the world is actually a sphere. And this may be something like that. Now, I'm not ruling out the possibility that what was called naphtha in 1 Maccabees chapter 1 might indeed have been something other than that. I'm not aware of any, like, say, lighter fluid or even gasoline, which is highly combustible. You can pour that out on the sidewalk, or you can pour that out on a sacrificial altar. It's not going to catch on fire. No matter how hot the sun is in the sky, it's not going to catch on fire. So I see here the possibility that it was miraculous, not because the substance, which may well be that form of petroleum oil, which would be flammable in itself. I could see easily that the miracle was that even though it was in itself flammable, it caught on fire spontaneously. That, I think, would qualify as a miracle. I mean, if there was no fire put to it and suddenly it just started blazing, well, you'd have to say, well, how did that happen? And if there was no natural explanation for how that happened, the possibility of it being a miracle is there. The same is true with, say, like I said, gasoline. If you pour gasoline out on some surface outside and it's a very hot day, you can wait and wait and wait. It's not going to catch on fire. And if in the absence of a match or lightning or sparks or any other type of combustion, any other cause of lighting a fire, if that were absent and suddenly the gasoline just suddenly caught on fire, well, how do you explain that? So in itself, it doesn't seem to me that this is kind of like a proof that either that book of Scripture is not inspired, or that what the Bible in that case says to be a miracle wasn't really a miracle. It may well have been a miracle for that reason alone. Now, as far as the issue of David using, or Daniel rather, using the term earlier, that's not something that I have the adequate knowledge to be able to speak to. That's something that maybe a good commentary on Scripture would be able to reveal more information on that. But in any case, as far as the water, the heavy water itself goes, or the thick water itself, I don't think that that is outside the possibility of indeed being a miracle. This email comes in from Vince. He says, a while back, Patrick, you read a letter from an atheist named Jack. He says, although I'm a fairly steady listener, I have never heard your former discussions with Jack. That being said, I would like to submit a possible basis for Jack's arguments. Maybe a basis that Jack is hesitant to admit. When we hear the word atheist, we naturally focus on what this person doesn't believe, but rarely delve into what fills that empty space. I have found that many atheists, possibly Jack fits in this category, believe that the reason for maintaining or striving for a sense of morality is that they believe that an alien race seeded us here, and when we achieve the proper amount of moral evolution, they will return and coexist with us. I'm going to pause here. It's interesting and kind of ironic, but in a good way, because actually I touched upon that very issue yesterday. It was yesterday. I couldn't remember if it was Friday or yesterday. It was yesterday that I recall when I talked about how Ben Stein was interviewing Richard Dawkins for his movie called Expelled. And that's a movie about how references to God have been eliminated from the public school classrooms. And there's a section where he's interviewing Richard Dawkins, the famous British atheist. He's a scientist. I believe his field is zoology, if I'm not mistaken. And he's a prolific author who has really publicly excoriated believers for being superstitious and anti-science, in his view anyway. And there's a moment in this interview where Ben Stein asks him, where did life on Earth come from? And after a bit of hemming and hawing, Richard Dawkins says what you just said a moment ago, Vince, and that is that maybe aliens came to this planet and quote-unquote seeded the planet with life. So he doesn't talk about moral evolution per se, but that's just his, I would say, inept attempt to try to at least offer a theory. He doesn't say that's exactly what happened or that he believes that that's what happened, but he says it's possible that that's what happened. So yes, familiar with that. So continuing on, the reason, Vince says, many of these atheists fail to discuss this part of their belief system is because the amount of faith required to believe that scenario goes against their arguments regarding faith in general. Just a thought. He says, if we have learned anything, it's that nature abhors a vacuum. This extends to belief systems. It is extremely difficult for people to believe a strict negative without pairing that negative with an opposing positive, no matter how far-reaching. He says, I love listening to your show. I don't always agree with you, but our disagreements are minor overall and more along the lines of iron sharpening iron. God bless, Vince. Vince, thank you, and God bless you too. So to your point, yes, I would concur that when you make a denial of something, that denial generally entails some sort of affirmation. So in the case of an atheist who says, I deny the existence of God. A lot of people who style themselves as atheists, they're probably closer to agnostics. An agnostic, properly speaking, is somebody who professes not to know. I don't know if any gods exist. I don't know if a God exists. So since I don't know, and since I really doubt you can ever really know for sure, I'm just going to assume that God doesn't exist. But I'm kind of an open-minded skeptic. That to me summarizes the stance that I've seen in some of the agnostic folk that I've talked to over the years. Now, an atheist would be more militant, more hardcore, at least in the claim that no gods exist. And your Christian God, you know, he doesn't exist. And any other gods, Hindus or whoever else believes in whatever gods, they don't exist either. And to give an example of what you're referring to, Vince, here, is that that's the negative statement. I deny that X exists. Well, okay, if X doesn't exist, what do you believe exists? And usually, typically, atheists will fall back upon a worldview, which really is the underpinning of atheism, if you ask me, and that is the worldview of scientism. Now, scientism in this context refers to the belief or the presupposition that the only things that exist are physical, are material, and therefore susceptible to science. And if science is the study of pre-given realities that happen to be physical, and your worldview is that the only things that exist in the universe, and maybe there are other multi-universes out there, okay, whatever, it's still just physical. And so I do believe that that's a very good and helpful way to approach the topic with somebody who holds that view, would be to, first of all, find out, is this what you believe? Or do you, in fact, believe in the possibility of an afterlife? Do you believe in the possibility of immaterial realities that are not purely natural or not even natural at all? Well, give me an example. Well, what about love? Is love something you can find physically in a store someplace? Obviously not. It's real, and you know it's real because you live your life every single day knowing that you love certain people and certain people love you. But you can't prove that scientifically. There's no way to prove scientifically with the scientific method or with scientific instruments or observation. You can't prove that your kids love you. You can't prove that your wife loves you in any scientific way, but it's still true, and you know it's true. And you see it by its effects that are not reducible to scientific inquiry. So I think it's a helpful way to approach the topic, because often they get bogged down when in a conversation where there are angry feelings and people cut each other off, and that's never a good thing. I'd like to try to keep the dialogue open if possible. And so it seems to me that talking about that issue from that standpoint is a good way to go about it. Sorry, so I'm keeping track of the clock here. And I think Yeah, I think we are in break time. Break time land. Boy, it comes quickly. So we'll do that. We'll take a quick time out. We'll come back with more of your emails here on the Patrick Madrid Show. And once again, if you'd like to send me an email, just go to the show page, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on links and click on contact, and you can send me an email that will come directly to me. I'll be more than happy to read it. I read every email that comes to me, good, bad, or indifferent. And sometimes, time permitting, I'm able to do what I'm doing today and share them with you on the air. I'll be right back.
Good evening. This is Tom Brokaw, NBC Nightly News. The internet has collapsed. National security officials are now blaming it on the high volume of emails being sent to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
We'll have more tonight on the NBC Nightly News.
You've got mail.
Mail time.
Mail time.
It's mail time?
Mail
already?
Time.
Really? Okay, we'll be right there, mailbox.
Got a box full of letters.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Some things that you might like to see.
Okay, we're doing emails today, as I promised. This morning at the beginning of the show, I said, I have a feeling we're going to stay with emails for the rest of the show, and so it has happened. Mainly because we just have so many wonderful emails that have come in, and it's an interesting way to take questions, a little bit different from phone calls, but we will be doing phone calls again in the not-too-distant future. This one comes in from, actually, I don't even really have a name for this person, but it comes in from a Twitter account that, if I said it to you, probably wouldn't mean anything, because it's just like, it's hard to tell what it means. But in any case, this person says, can you recommend a good book to understand the differences and similarities of the Armenian Apostolic Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, especially on the matter of baptism and confirmation? Yeah, I think I can't. So I would recommend a book by Father Aidan Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S. He is a Dominican friar. He's a scholar who teaches theology at Cambridge University in England. And he's written a number of really wonderful books. The one I have in mind for you is called Rome and the Eastern Churches. And it is an historical and theological overview of not only the history of how it is that these Eastern churches, these different Eastern Orthodox churches, wound up breaking communion with the Church of Rome, the Catholic Church specifically, how it is that they went into schism, each in different ways and at different times. But the nice thing is that it's a non-polemical book. It's easy to get polemical when you talk about this issue, because very often the believers in those Orthodox churches will quickly say, well, we didn't leave the Catholic Church left us, stuff like that. So it can devolve into polemics pretty quickly, and this book doesn't do that. So this book by Father Aidan Nichols is a very calm, it's not overly scholarly, but there's plenty there in terms of explanation of what the timeline looked like and, you know, why people hold the views that they hold. And this would also get into some of the theological issues. So with regard to baptism and confirmation, please note that some of the apparent distinctives are actually, in some cases, not in all, but in some cases, they are really a matter more of semantics than anything else, and a difference in terminology. So whereas in the Catholic Church, we refer to the sacrament of initiation as the sacrament of confirmation, in the Eastern churches, generally, not every last one of them, but they would typically refer to that sacrament as chrismation because of the chrism, the holy oil of chrism that is used in the sacrament of confirmation. And so they're talking about the same thing we are, but they have a different name for it. And in some cases, even some of these apparent theological distinctions are not really all that distinct after all. So another example, and you'll see this in your consideration of the Armenian Apostolic Orthodox Church. In the Catholic Church, we use a term called purgatory to describe the state or the condition or the place, if you prefer that term, of those disembodied souls who are, as St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 10, they're experiencing the purifying effects of the flames that reveal their life, their works that were built upon the foundation of Jesus Christ. And we're told, I believe I talked about this on the program yesterday, we're told in 1 Corinthians 3 that this involves suffering because those things are being burned away. So it hurts, but it hurts so good because at the end of that purification process, we're told, as St. Paul says, the man will be saved. So he's not in heaven yet, but he will be in heaven as soon as all of these defects and the bad works of his life are burned away as though by fire. So he says he will be saved, but only as though passing through fire. We call that purgatory, and it's from a Latin word that means to purify or to purge your body of anything that's unclean, or in this case, your soul. Well, in the Orthodox world, they have the same general understanding. They don't call it purgatory, but we can see this in their prayers for those who have died. So they pray for the souls of people in the church who have died. Now, that would be pointless if there were no purgatory, or if there were no condition or state that we Catholics call purgatory, that they may have a different word for, or if they even bothered to use a word at all, but they still pray for the souls of those who have died. And that's evidence of the fact that they realize, they recognize, just as we do, that there is this process that takes place for some people that is not heaven and it's not hell. And it's not a place where people who are too good for hell go, but not good enough for heaven, or vice versa. That's never been what the church teaches on this issue, but rather that those who are not ready to see God face to face, or as it says in Revelation 21:27, nothing unclean can enter heaven, that God purifies the soul and prepares it to meet him face to face. So in the Orthodox churches, they pray for those who have died, and they pray for them because that's where they are, those who are there in our need of our prayers. If they're in heaven, they don't need our prayers. All the Eastern Orthodox believers would agree with that. If they're in hell, our prayers can't do them any good anyway. So the only biblical and theological reason to pray for somebody is if he has need of it in the afterlife, and that would be what we Catholics call purgatory. So there's another example of where we use terminology that's different, and it could seem to suggest that the differences are larger than they really are. Now, there are some real large differences, like the authority of the Pope, for example, or the filioque clause. That's the phrase in Latin that means "and the Son," where in the Creed we say we believe that the Holy Spirit is sent by the Father and the Son, filioque and the Son. The Orthodox churches don't have that, and it's a big point of contention because it was added in the West around the 4th or 5th century. It was added as part of the church's arsenal against the Arian heresy, and the Eastern Catholics got ticked off because you didn't consult us, and that's not what we said in the councils. So it turned into this big imbroglio that has simmered and flared up ever since. So again, back to that book by Father Aidan Nichols, Rome and the Eastern Churches. He does a really good job of presenting these details in a calm and readable way. Furthermore, I would suggest the writings of a late convert to the Catholic Church from Russian Orthodoxy. His name was Vladimir Soloviev. And he wrote at the close of the 19th century. I don't remember exactly when he died. He might have died at the end of the 19th century. But he was kind of like a John Henry Newman character. St. John Henry Newman converted to the Catholic Church from Anglican Protestantism. And he was a vociferous anti-Catholic. And he wound up becoming Catholic and wound up defending the Catholic Church in the face of some of the very same criticisms that he himself used to make before he wised up and figured out the facts of history. So Soloviev, who was raised a Russian Orthodox, and he was a Russian Orthodox believer for years, when he became Catholic, he felt the need, and I'm glad he did, but he felt the need to try to help his erstwhile fellow Orthodox brethren understand the Catholic Church in a way that was not the caricature that some of them had been exposed to, many of them. And so his writings are available kind of in a serialized form at the Catholic Answers website, catholic.com. And Father Ray Ryland in particular, the late Father Ray Ryland, he was instrumental in writing some articles about Soloviev and bringing to a popular audience nowadays some of the things that Soloviev had to say. I think that would be helpful as well. Here's an email that comes in from Judy. She says, "Hi, Patrick. I'm a mail carrier in central Wisconsin. I listen to your show and other shows on Relevant Radio while I deliver the mail. Thank you for what you do. Please know that my prayers go out to you and everybody at Relevant Radio. I find my past events in my life in so many of your callers and another of your truth and love answers have really helped heal some of my life wounds. Thank you so much." And Judy mentions that she's been a Relevant Radio listener and supporter for the past 12 years. First of all, that's awesome. And I'm really glad that Relevant Radio is having that effect on you. And Judy, I must say, I really think that you speak for a lot of people out there for whom Relevant Radio is not just a source of information and encouragement, but also it gets into some of the very issues that you and I and Cyrus and everybody listening to Relevant Radio in some way or another has experience with, whether it's sin or loneliness or whatever it may be. People are people, and we all have similar experiences. So for me, that's a big part of what I love about doing the program. Thank you. I think they trust us at Relevant Radio, and it's a trust that's earned over time. And that's one of the things, too, I guess on the other side of the coin, is that sometimes people, they just dip in and they listen to something quickly, and they don't either hear all of it or they don't hear the context, and it might make them angry. And every so often we get those nasty grams from people who are angry because of what they heard or what they think they heard. And more often than not, if they go back and listen, or maybe listen a bit more, they realized it wasn't quite what they thought. We see a lot of that too, don't we? So Judy, thank you. I can just picture you out there in the wind and the rain and the snow and the sun and all the things that can't stop the mail from being delivered. And I appreciate you taking a moment to write in and share that with us. This is from Karen, who says, "Patrick, thank you for addressing an unfortunate situation, even though it increases my discomfort level. The main reason for this event," referring to, I'm not sure which event she's referring to, but apparently it's something I covered on the show. She said, "Even though it increases my discomfort level, the reason for this event and any other recent event is due to the elimination of God, Christianity, and religion in general from the media, society, culture, education, and the family. One caller that she's referring to on a show that she heard says that one common aspect of current events is violence. I agree. People are increasingly afraid, frustrated, and don't know whom to trust. Violence has been with us since the beginning and ever shall be. Not everyone is tactful." She says, "Nonetheless, Patrick, I love your show and your reasonableness in discussing the faith." She says she appreciates the kind of questions that people ask about the Catholic faith and that they sometimes don't know a good way to ask the question or voice their opinion, but she appreciates that they can get an answer to those things here. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for the kind email, and we will do our very best to answer as many questions as we can with charity and wisdom and patience. Sometimes those can be in short supply, so we do try hard to do that here. All right, well, I'm getting the high sign from Cyrus. We'll take a quick time out. We will come back with the last part of the program today, and we'll do that right after this.
Life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
There are places I remember all my life.
As promised, straight back to the emails that have come in. This one comes in from Kathy, and she's writing from Wisconsin. She says, "I came across Relevant Radio about a year ago. I was driving and looking for a clear station. I've always been drawn to talk radio, so when I found your program, I was hooked. Honest, knowledgeable answers to anyone's questions. People just like me. Although I am a cradle Catholic who attended a Catholic elementary school, I have learned much more about the faith from your answers than through my education. And while I rarely miss Mass, it had been over 40 years since I had gone to confession. Most likely, it was when I was confirmed. listening to your reasoning brought me back to the confessional last Good Friday. She says, I listen to you every day, and I must say, the more I listen to you, the longer my... I laughed the first time I read this. I can't help but laugh again. She says, the longer my list of sins becomes. LOL. I also enjoy...
that's funny. I like that.
You know how I'm going to interpret that? I think it's this, that the more knowledgeable people become and the more sensitive their consciences become because they become more and more formed, you just can't help but be more aware. And maybe some things that never really occurred to you that might be sinful, suddenly when you realize, uh-oh, I probably shouldn't be doing that. I have a feeling that's what she's referring to.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you feel like your list of sins gets longer each time you... produce the Patrick
McGill
show?
No comment?
Oh, darn. There's another one I got to add to the list. Well, we're all in this together, that's for sure. So she says, she says, I just figured out today, this is Kathy in Wisconsin, I just figured out today that when Drew prays the Divine Mercy Chaplet at 3 p.m. and prays the Hail Holy Queen, all this time, I thought that it said mourning and weeping in this belly of tears. Today, I brought the magnificent Advent companion home from church and I read the prayer in there. It says valley in this valley of tears. She says, I'm glad that I got that figured out. It struck me as kind of funny. God bless you all at Relevant Radio. Mourning and weeping in this belly of tears. That is pretty funny.
Have you ever seen the misheard lyrics where people sing along the famous?
Funny. Yeah,
it's funny. That just reminded me of that.
CCR's Bad Moon on the Rise. I knew a girl in high school who honestly thought that there's a bathroom on the right.
There's a bathroom on the right. That's great. That's so fun. Hey, I've got one here. This came in through Facebook, and I know Twitter is your main mode of communicating with everybody, but a lot of people still use Facebook, and here's one. This came from Tom. A question related to those whose baptism wasn't valid. We have heard that an invalid baptism invalidates the sacraments of confession, First Communion, Confirmation, and Holy Orders. Does an invalid baptism also invalidate the sacrament of matrimony? If so, why is that viewed differently than when a Catholic sacramentally marries a non-Catholic?
Ah, okay. There's a good question in there, and it's kind of wrapped inside a couple of misunderstandings. So as to the first part of your question, yes, a lack of a valid baptism would mean that you could not receive validly the other sacraments. Now, you could receive the Holy Eucharist. Let's just draw a circle around that for a minute. Unlike the other sacraments, the Holy Eucharist is a sacrament unto itself, and its validity depends upon at the altar when the priest is celebrating Mass, if he's using valid form and matter, so unleavened wheat bread and grape wine, and he uses the proper form, which are the words of consecration. Most fundamentally, it is, this is my body and this is my blood. There's more to the prayer that's said at Mass, but that's not, strictly speaking, necessary in order for the priest to confect the sacrament. And then the third thing would be his intention. He has to have that. And then the fourth thing would be he has to be a validly ordained priest. So if all of those are in place, as they virtually always are, then the sacrament itself is valid. But when you receive that sacrament as an unbaptized person, it does nothing for you. It doesn't confer grace. It can't confer grace because your soul is inert, spiritually speaking. And the only way that it can cooperate with and receive grace and grow in grace is if it has already been regenerated, which is what baptism does. So sometimes people will say, well, a lack of a valid baptism will invalidate all the other sacraments. And I know what they mean by that, and it is true of the other sacraments in general. But in that particular sense, it's not invalidating the Holy Eucharist because it would be valid unto itself, whether or not it was spiritually fruitful for you. But what about matrimony? Well, here are the misunderstandings. The sacrament of holy matrimony is not conferred by the priest for the couple. It's conferred by the man and the wife. So the husband confers the sacrament on the wife. The wife confers the sacrament on the husband. The priest is there as the official minister to witness in the name of the church, this union of the man and the woman, but he does not confer the sacrament. So what this means is that if one party or both parties are not baptized, they can have, and do have, presumably, putatively, they have a valid marriage, but it would not be sacramental. Because going back to the nature of the sacrament of holy matrimony, in order to have a sacrament, the man confers it upon the woman, the woman confers it upon the man. But if one or the other is not baptized, not only can you not receive it, you also can't confer it. So for that reason, if it should happen that somebody finds out that he or she was invalidly baptized, that would extend to the sacramentality of the marriage, not the validity of the marriage. It would not affect the validity of the marriage. So once the other party is validly baptized, then the marriage becomes sacramental. So hopefully that clears it up. Was there more to that one, Cyrus?
Yeah, no, I do have one more, though.
Sure.
This is from Krishna, and he says, Patrick, my priest recommended that we use blessed salt water and oil in my cooking to help our particular family situation. We have adopted children who are fighting spiritual battles. Are there other items we should consider getting blessed?
Oh, that's a very good question. So having your home blessed, of course, is important. Have the priest come over, feed him a nice meal, and have him go through all the rooms of your home with holy water and pray prayers of blessing and deliverance that God would drive away all evil spirits that might be lurking around. I encourage that on a fairly regular basis. Do that every few years. It's not that it wears out or wears off. It's not like there's, the date on the food in the grocery store after which you're not supposed to eat it. It's not like that. But it's a great way to renew this reality of your home being dedicated to Jesus. In the same way that you don't tell your wife, I love you once and then never again, you tell her you love her all the time because it's a great way of renewing and reinforcing the reality of your love for her. The same is true for blessing your home and blessing things in your home. So have blessed images of Jesus and Mary. Get the Sacred Heart of Jesus image and the Immaculate Heart of Mary image and enthrone them. All you have to do is Google that, enthronement of the Sacred Heart of Jesus image, and you'll find the prayer. You can do it yourself in your own home. You can go down to your local Catholic bookstore and get a copy, not a copy, get these images of Jesus and Mary and then enthrone them in your home. And what that means is you put them in some place of prominence and honor so that everybody who comes into your home, as well as all who live in the home, they see those images and they know that Jesus is the king of this household. And that Our Lady has a very special place at the center of the family's love for the Lord. It also puts, as I like to say, all the spiritual entities, diabolical entities, it puts them on notice that they're not welcome there. So I would do that. Have them blessed. Have your rosaries blessed. Take them to church and ask the priest to bless them. If you are in the habit, or if you'd like to get in the habit of wearing a brown scapular, that's a great reminder, kind of like a wedding ring. The brown scapular reminds you of your devotion to our Blessed Mother. It's not magical. It's not superstitious. It doesn't have any magical properties, nor does your wedding ring. But your wedding ring is a real symbol of a reality that exists that the ring symbolizes. So you're committed to your husband or to your wife. And so the scapular is a great way to do that. Another one would be the miraculous medal. When Our Lady appeared in France in the early 19th century, she promised great graces from God to those who, in faith, wore the miraculous medal as a sign of their love for Mary, but also their love for Jesus and their trust in God and His graces. She said that God would grant many great graces to those who wear the miraculous medal in faith. Again, it's not superstitious. It's not a good luck charm. Doesn't have any special powers, but it's like a wedding ring. It is a reminder. So these are all things that I think any Catholic family should do and would be well to do. Well, that's about all the time we've got. It's amazing that we were able to get through so many of your emails, and I sure appreciate you spending time to send them to me. Again, if you want to send me an email, go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on links and then click on contact. Actually, all you have to do is just click on contact and you'll be able to send me an email. Until next time, until tomorrow, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.